Okay, so this is our second our bonus podcast for the Double Bill this week. Or not this week, this season, I beg your pardon.
This is the revised special edition inserted scenes.
This is the ultimate edition.
Yeah.
Closely to be followed by the final edition, then the final plus one edition.
And then we will sell the stripped down original edition again.
Yes, to all the fans that demand it.
Yeah.
But then make a slight change so they buy it a third time.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we'll change the box and we'll sell it again.
Of course. And by then it won't be sort of podcasts and downloads. It'll be, you know, holograms
feed into
and
your
stuff.
Brain
so we'll make it 3D. We'll actually, we'll reconvert this podcast as a 3D podcast. That's what we're going to do.
And then we'll, finally get off our asses after 20 years and do a sequel to our other franchise.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be awful.
Yeah.
Where monkeys were quiffs and things.
After, of course, we do our prequel podcast.
Our prequel podcast, of course.
Which will be a lot snazzier, but a lot less integral to full enjoyment.
Faster, more intense.
Okay, so this is podcast number two for the Star Wars box set. It's our bonus podcast. The first podcast covered the films themselves. And now we're going to start looking at the wider world around the films, both the sequels, prequels, spin-offs, etc., and also the real-world influences of Star Wars and the influences on Star Wars. Just a little bit of backstory on the Star Wars saga, on sort of George Lucas and his making the film. If any of this is wrong, by the way, you have to stop me and tell me if you know any of this is wrong. I'm
going to know more of the history of Star Wars than you, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Star Wars would be my mastermind specialist subject.
Yeah.
Not the sort of the expanded universe, not the books and stuff, but the films,
the trilogy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not even all six films or nine films if you count the spin-offs.
The proper trilogy.
Yes, but I love them. So anyway. Yeah. Star Wars began life as George Lucas's desire to create kind of a Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon style adventure. He originally wanted to go for a Flash Gordon film, but the rights were held by Dino De Laurentiis, and we all know how that turned out.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't let George Lucas make the films because he didn't trust such a new filmmaker. So George Lucas had to go back to the drawing board and basically create, in the same way that he was doing at the same time with Indiana Jones, create his own version of the story. And it went through many drafts, many sort of changes, many sort of iterations of the script. It started very much as a kind of a B-movie, you know, lots of really cheesy kind of special effects descriptions, lots of cheesy kind of characterizations. There was one bit in at least the first four drafts where I think it was Anakin Starkiller or General Kenobi or one of the main characters, what would eventually turn into the Ben Kenobi character, smashes his arm against the table, revealing a bionic arm there. And he's saying, you know, I'm more machine now than man, and it's all very cheesy. And you see where the influence sort of fills in with the rest of the films with Darth Vader and
absolutely, in that line.
But it's very sort of cheesy the way it's written in the script. The Death Star at the end is attacked by a group of Wookiee piloted devil fighters, and it's all very very 1930s. It's not what it actually became, which is kind of like a gritty 70s. It's almost like the French Connection in space. There's a real sort of gritty realism to it, which wasn't there in the original scripts. So George Lucas wasn't allowed, basically, to make this Flash Gordon property. So he had to then go and make his own property based on the same kind of on the same genres.
Yeah.
And you know, through budget restraints, through rewrites, through speaking to his friends, you know, Francis Ford Coppola and guy that made Carrie.
Brian De Palma.
And Brian De Palma. And various others of that ilk, sort of the sort of late 70s movie brats.
Yeah.
He came up with what became Star Wars. It's not a very big budget film, even for the time. It cost $9,999,999. That was the budget that was given to them by Alan Ladd Jr. at Fox. Alan Ladd Jr., by the way, who actually was forced to resign from Fox after he gave George Lucas a very sort of generous deal when it came to The Empire Strikes Back. Alan Ladd Jr. was an amazing man by all accounts. He was a proper film producer, and he was sort of edged out by the bureaucrats and the accountants.
Of course, he actually sort of liked to foster, you know, the development of films that would be, enjoyable as opposed to...
Apparently he read Star Wars and said, "I don't understand a word that you've written, but I can tell that you do, so here's the money.
Yeah.
So he obviously, he knew talent. He knew what filmmakers were.
Yeah, you know. He knew how to let filmmakers make films.
Exactly.
Which is why, as a producer, he was unpopular.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, he'd made THX 1138, which was a feature version of one of his earlier student films, which didn't do very well. It's regarded better now than it was then. It's a really good film, actually.
Yeah.
It's sort of in the style of Logan's Run or 2001. It's a very slow, ponderous, thoughtful sort of sci-fi film. Of course, on DVD, you can only get the special edition with all the CG upgrades. but it is a very, very good film. And then he made American Graffiti, which did well.
Yeah.
It did really well, but it didn't do really well until after he'd already been okay to do Star Wars. So when it hit big...
Yeah.
Obviously, the people sort of started to come to him to sort of try and get the money towards him so they could get money back off him.
Absolutely.
So he went and made Star Wars, and a lot of people didn't understand it. A lot of people didn't like it. Even the actors that were in it and the crew that were making it were like, oh, yeah, working on a kid's film, yeah.
There's that quote from Harrison Ford, isn't it? You can type this.
Yeah, you can type this SH1T, but you can't speak it.
Yeah.
So there was a great deal of resentment towards him. And in fact, apparently, George Lucas had to go off with stress at some point late in the development. Because he just couldn't take all these people sort of questioning him and complaining at him. And of course, the American work ethic is very different from the British work ethic. The American work ethic is the director is God.
Yeah.
The British work ethic is, you know, if you're not paying me past 5 o'clock, I'm not working past 5 o'clock. Which I must say, I completely agree with. I think, you know...
It's definitely my work ethic.
Yeah. But George Lucas wasn't used to working that way, so of course he was getting stressed from that way as well.
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, it became Star Wars and it became very popular and very successful. Mm-hmm. And when it came to The Empire Strikes Back, he basically took out a loan off his own back. He put his own personal money into it, the profits he'd got from the merchandise around Star Wars, and also like this huge bank loan. And again, you know, it was Star Wars was a big success, but would The Empire Strikes Back do as well? No one knew at the time. So it was a huge risk he was taking, and he hired his old film school professor, Irving Kirshner, to direct it. And again, that became a huge, huge success after, you know, sort of difficult times during the production
the
when it went
gestation,
over budget and
yeah.
whatnot. Exactly, yeah. So then when Return of the Jedi came about, he basically had all the money he wanted to make it, and it was a much, much easier production, I think, for Lucasfilm and for George Lucas. See, that's a real sort of in the nutshell kind of history of the making of Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's sort of young, ambitious filmmaker rising up through the ranks, through his talents, eventually becoming this huge, huge blockbuster director, and then not directing another film for almost 20 years.
When we first met, he was but the apprentice, but now he is the master, you might say.
Indeed,
yeah.
The circle is complete.
Yeah, he was definitely pulling the strings by Jedi, like you said, is it Richard Markwin?
Yes,
know, was selected because it was somebody maybe that wouldn't push back.
Yeah,
and Lucas would have a bit more.
Apparently, Irving Kirshner was offered the chance to direct Return of the Jedi.
Yeah,
And he refused because he just spent 3 years making The Empire Strikes Back, and he didn't want to spend another 3 years of his life making Return of the Jedi. That's why he refused.
Which is understandable, yeah.
Which I suppose understandable, but it doesn't answer the question. You know, did George Lucas want someone that was more malleable, or was he? You know, did he want Irving Kirshner again? Because it's on record. It's very, very common knowledge that The Empire Strikes Back is the least favorite of his films. Even though it is regarded by practically everybody else as the best of the Star Wars films.
I wondered if it was maybe something like, you know, it was offered to Kirsch because of a sort of, you know, professional courtesy maybe, and it's still his professor, someone he looks up to, you know, and so on. And B, obviously, the Empire was a runaway success, and the business...
Kirsch was offered before he'd finished it.
Oh, before he'd... Right.
Yeah, so...
So, and then maybe if Irving Kirshner decided not to do it, maybe Lucas said, right, if I can't get my old friend and mentor to do it, I want someone... It's maybe a bit of both.
Yeah,
you know,
okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So
if you're listening, George, you know, write and let us know which one.
Please don't take any of the rest of the stuff we say personally.
Now, as we said on the last podcast, we love George Lucas circa 1971 to 1980.
I actually said something about George Lucas the other day at my parents' house. I made some quip, I can't remember.
All right.
My dad said, I think you're being unfair there. I think George Lucas is a great filmmaker. I said, because American Graffiti is one of my dad's favourite films.
Okay.
As is Star Wars. But I said, yeah, but Dad, what are you basing that on? He goes, well, American Graffiti and Star Wars and the second one. I said, the new ones? He says, oh, I don't really pay attention to them. So that's exactly my point.
Yeah. You know? So, I mean, if you look at the films...
I love the same George Lucas that you do.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's
but
it.
There's a new one now.
It's George. It's the Anakin Skywalker George Lucas, not the Darth Vader George Lucas. Not the Lucas that's gone to the dark side of money and special effects.
Yeah.
If you look at the films that he has done, you know, THX is a great film, and I would advise anyone. I think it's recently out on Blu-ray, so, you know, go and track it down. It's a really, really decent film. Not that I advocate the taking of any illegal narcotics whatsoever, but apparently it's one of those films like 2001 where if you ingest things you're not meant to, it can enhance the experience. So again, don't do that, but if you're the kind of person that does it anyway, you know, watch THX. It's a great film. American Graffiti is really good. It's not the kind of film that I'd watch over and over, because I don't really like real life.
Yeah.
You know, I like sort of either fantasy, sci-fi,
myths, fables.
And then Star Wars, which is fantastic. And those are the three early films he directed, and they're all really good. Then you look at the films he produced. Empire Strikes Back, fantastic. Raiders of the Lost Ark, fantastic. Temple of Doom, fantastic. Okay, not as good as Raiders, but still fantastic. Return of the Jedi, fantastic. Last Crusade, fantastic. Yeah. Willow, good.
Yeah.
Very, very Willow's good. Certainly until The Lord of the Rings, the best fantasy film Hollywood pumped out.
I'll take Willow over any of the Star Wars prequels. Maybe not Sith, actually.
No.
But yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's more honest. You know, it's basically a fantasy Star Wars in a time before the cynicism kicked in.
Absolutely, yeah.
So Willow is very good. Howard the Duck, maybe not. Labyrinth, fantastic.
Yeah, Labyrinth's great, yeah.
So there's a real... The Rocketeer was Lucasfilm.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's a great film. So there's a real sort of pedigree for Lucasfilm in the 70s, 80s, and even maybe the early 90s.
I think he's a far better producer, and sort of he's a great ideas man.
He's an ideas man, absolutely.
Because even the prequels that we all deride, you know,
it's not
that they're a bad idea.
No, a lot of the ideas are fantastic. It's just the execution that's a little bit sloppy, and in the casting of Jake Lloyd, very sloppy.
And Hayden Christensen.
And Hayden Christensen,
Really, in the casting of Skywalker family, we got lucky in the 70s, and then we kind of got... Well, no, Shmi's Skywalker in the first one.
Yes, it's really, it's just Anakin. It's the curse of the dark side affecting the casting of that character. For anyone who has the internet, obviously you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. go on YouTube. There is an interview from some sci-fi website with Jake Lloyd, a 19-year-old Jake Lloyd, a couple of years back.
Right.
And he's turned into such an arrogant little SOB.
Yeah.
And he's ugly as well. And he gave up acting after Phantom Menace, which you'd have to, really, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
if you were nine and you'd just been Anakin Skywalker in the Phantom Menace, you'd have to give up acting.
Yeah, that would just be a...
Yeah, who's going to hire Darth Vader that goes yippee, exactly. But he's apparently... Well, he didn't come off very well in the interview.
Does he need to work? I mean, he's got Darth Vader money, you know.
But he doesn't, you see, because James Earl Jones has four Darth Vader films. He has that kind of Darth Vader money. Jake Lloyd... Maybe his parents have Darth Vader money, but he has Phantom Menace Darth Vader money.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, so anyway, where were we? Yes, pedigree, fantastic, up until about 1999. Yeah. In fact, some would argue up until 1997, when the special editions came out. There's a lot that I like about the special editions. I think any of the CG spaceships are a great addition. Any of the original special effects that were redone... I think most of them were really, really good. It's the additions that I don't like.
Added in bits,
it's the added in Wampa, which is unnecessary to the nth degree. And George Lucas says, you know, there's a lot of people who say that, you know, seeing less of it is more dramatic, but I wanted to see more of it. No excuse. You wanted to make more money, so you added in scenes that you thought people would pay to see. That's the bottom line, and therefore it's the wrong reason to make it.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think, like you say, extra X-Wings, or sort of polished shots of the Falcon flying or something.
A little sort of shockwave out of the Death Star, fine.
I'm absolutely down with all of that stuff, but we don't need... even things like the... It's not as bad as the Wampa, but there's a shot in Star Wars when Luke and Obi-Wan and the droids enter Mos Eisley, and they go past one of the big, tall giraffe-looking things that rears up, and a couple of unfortunate Jawas get plucked off by strings.
Yeah.
And it's all right. I don't think CG hadn't quite got there yet. That you know, doing the machines with the CG in the late 90s looked fine, but But flesh and blood creatures hadn't quite caught up yet.
And the CG dewback, the sort of big lizard thing outside the cantina,
And that, you know, that shot, had it already existed and they were polishing it, would be fine.
But because they've added
adding it.
It
in, I was I think they added it in too early.
On the one hand, I think that the expanded Mos Eisley is great.
Yeah.
Because it does look like a parochial little village in the first film. And it looks like a bustling spaceport in the second, in the special edition. But I agree, and especially drawing attention to it with the Jawas swinging off and squealing. If they just had it in the background, just stood looking around or chewing on some cud or something.
Yeah, there's additional Banthas added in the background.
To Return of the Jedi.
Yes, but no, also in the first one, the Luxor droids.
Jubaks.
It's a Jubak, and that's fine.
Yeah.
It's in the background, it's just an extra detail,
And you don't focus on it, so you don't notice the flaws, whereas...
The one at Mos Eisley, it becomes a little set piece almost, you know, a 5-second set piece all on its own.
Yeah,
and it draws too much attention to it, I think, too soon, because the technology wasn't there yet. It was getting there.
It was, yeah.
You know, but it wasn't there.
With The Empire Strikes Back, again, you've got the added Wampa, which you don't need. It's really, really unnecessary.
I need to take that back, actually. The technology wasn't there yet. Jurassic Park came out 4 years earlier.
Yeah, the technology was there.
The technology was
there.
Yeah. It was just being misapplied.
Absolutely,
So
you had extra Wampa, which you didn't need. You had extra Cloud City, which I think helps. And this
is extra Cloud
where
City
you
bits.
Draw the line. You need, I don't know, not a committee, but you need some sort of intelligent fanboys to go in with a...
Malk and Benji.
With a stamp saying Fabuloso and a stamp saying must try harder and just stamp the scenes we like. And
I think that was it. I think, to be fair to George Lucas, he'd been afforded an opportunity here that very few filmmakers have.
Yeah.
And some would argue few filmmakers would want. A lot of filmmakers, you know, they finish their piece, they're happy with it. But with Star Wars being set in such a fantastic universe, you know, and with the advances in special effects that he'd, you know... In the 70s, he'd kick-started this thing, and then in the 90s, other people took it and ran.
There's a famous quote that George Lucas has about the special editions, which is, directors don't finish films, or it's a quote from directors that films are never finished, they're only abandoned.
Yeah.
And so he had the chance to go back and finish them, which is fine, but then when you abandon something, release it into the world, and then everyone loves it.
Yeah.
Can you then go back and change it? Do you have the right to go back and change it?
You risk changing the very things that people
absolutely
love in the first place. But I think, you know, I think had I made films like Star Wars and then had I been afforded this opportunity to go in and, you know, add bits and tweak it, I would probably take it. But it's like you say, there needs to be a sort of a firmer decision-making process. I think it was, he got all sort of caught up in the ability and it's just, started firing in extra shots and extra beasties.
And he doesn't really have people working at Lucas Ranch anymore that say, actually, George, that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
He is the only person that can okay an idea or poo-poo an idea.
Absolutely.
They all just do his bidding. He is the emperor of Lucasfilm.
I think the only people, the impression certainly I get is the only people sort of professionally that he'll maybe listen to some, you know, resistance from are Spielberg and Harrison Ford. Which is why Crystal Skulls is, you know, good in places.
Yeah, I mean, Spielberg he'll listen to, and Ford, if Ford says no, then he'll change it. That's basically the relationship, isn't
it? Yeah,
But yeah, no, and I think Spielberg has a similar problem. You know, he's not exactly the best guy. And again, you know, I'm not criticising the careers of these two guys.
Oh,
they've done a lot better than I have, you know. Yeah. I'm 28 now, and by 28, they'd both done much...
Yeah,
if I'd been born in California in the 70s, maybe I'd have done more than I did now. You know, but you know, I'm not sort of I'm not saying that they're worthless. You know, they're both fantastic filmmakers. But yeah, Spielberg,
they're human.
Has some terrible ideas. You know, if you look at the ending of Minority Report, an otherwise fantastic film marred by a cheesy ending. AI, it's you know, two really decent ideas merged together in a way that doesn't work.
And finally, two really decent filmmakers in Spielberg and Kubrick, merging together in a way that just doesn't work.
Absolutely, I mean, can you imagine, like, you know, David Lynch and Michael Bay? It wouldn't work, would it, you know? Just one long explosion that turns into a vagina or something. It would be very bizarre.
Absolutely, I can see. I'd love to go and see a David Lynch film with Michael Bay. I reckon he wouldn't make it 5 minutes before he stormed out.
No,
nothing's happening. Nothing's. What the?
Taking a pen and a pad and just draw explosions, wouldn't he?
Wouldn't he just get so bored? Be like taking a 5-year-old to go and see There Will Be Blood or something. You know?
That's what Michael Bay is. He's a 5-year-old in There Will Be Blood.
No, I could have made a better Transformers movie when I was 5.
Well, yeah, you probably did with your
Transformers
toys.
I made a million Transformers movies when I was five in my back garden, and they were all better than... Well, they were better than the second one anyway. Uh-huh. Yeah. But anyway, this isn't about him. This
we
is
digress,
about George.
George and his baby.
His legacy.
So, I mean, when you... Yeah, so George Lucas, great pedigree. Some great films will come out of him, of which the original Star Wars trilogy are arguably the best.
I would say, yeah.
So... Should we move our gaze onto sort of the post-Star Wars era?
Yeah,
what's
absolutely.
Happened to cinema, specifically Hollywood cinema, since Star Wars? Even though George Lucas is an independent filmmaker, he's not in the Hollywood system. He very much is a California filmmaker, and Hollywood
absolutely.
Being the California film establishment, he has a relationship with it, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah.
So what's happened to Hollywood since Star Wars? What can we say Star Wars has done to improve cinema, and what can we say it's done to sort of, might, you know...
Yeah.
disparage it or demerit it?
Well, I think on the improvement side of things, again, we touched on it in part one when we were talking about the films themselves.
Uh-huh.
Special effects, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
We have this running gag about George Lucas having to CG everything in and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that awesome picture of him in the 70s surrounded by props, and then
yeah.
him in 2005 surrounded by green screen, you know, which
yeah.
is really funny. But, you know, it's true, both in the sort of the modern... age of CGI,
mm-hmm.
and in the 70s with the practical effects, he's been very much an advocate of, you know, special effects, of pushing the envelope, you know. And I think he's by no means the only person who was, you know, trying to push the envelope and improve things in the 70s, but certainly Star Wars, because of the Runaways success it was, and because of how much work he put into it,
yeah,
you know, I think modern cinema owes a great, particularly action and sci-fi cinema, you know, effects-driven films.
Yes.
Owe a massive debt to the original Star Wars, I think.
Absolutely.
It's fair to say.
Very, very much
it
so.
It really, really sort of pushed the field into, you know, a galaxy far, far away,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. So I think that's something we've definitely got to chalk up in the positive.
I agree, and you've got films like 2001: A Space Odyssey, where they
yeah.
were doing interesting things with special effects, and they were sort of
yeah.
changing the game almost with what they were doing technically. But nothing stands up to Star Wars. I mean, even if you look at 2001, you look at, you know, sort of all the films around that, you know, Soylent Green, The Omega
yeah.
Man, Logan's Run, they were phenomenal to look at, but none of them changed the face of special effects cinema
like
Star Wars did.
Again, it wasn't 2001 that made Ridley Scott want to make Alien. It was Star Wars.
Exactly.
You know, that's a very important one for me, you know.
Very much so. And the number of people who have cited Star Wars as the reason they got into films, or the reason
yeah.
that they got into making films or sci-fi or whatever, yeah, it outstrips any other film before, doesn't it? Any sort of previous sci-fi film.
Yeah. I think that there's also sort of... So, yeah, it certainly had a great influence on sort of fantastic... images and, you know, special effects behind the camera,
scenes, yeah.
But then also in the camera, in the fiction, you know, creating things like lightsabers, like Jedi,
yeah,
like, you know, not just the effects that made them, but the concepts behind them, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure some form of laser sword, you know, George Lucas maybe isn't the first person to have come up with
no,
that concept.
No, probably
I
not.
I don't know, but he certainly sort of. He gave it a name. He gave it a, you know.
Yes.
Now, if you watch something and somebody picks up a laser sword, in fact, Megatron does in the animated Transformers
uh-huh.
movie. And what did we say when we were kids? We're like, oh, look, Megatron's got a lightsaber.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's not called a laser sword or anything like that.
It's
They're called lightsabers.
Absolutely.
Now.
But I think if you look even deeper into what Star Wars did than just the specific technologies, you've got sort of taking mythology, taking sort of old world stories and old world ideas and turning them into science fiction,
yeah.
Is something which has happened an awful lot since. Even things like, you know, Waterworld.
Yeah.
You know, it takes sort of sci-fi and it takes sort of Mad Max and puts it on the water, but there's this underlying mythology of dry land and the Chosen One and all this kind of stuff. And that kind of started with Star Wars, really. And Star Wars was influenced by literature and by
yeah.
sort of history and by mythology, but it took it into the cinema. It took sort of big concept blend. I mean, The Matrix wouldn't have happened without Star Wars.
Oh, absolutely.
It owes more of a debt to sort of Hong Kong cinema and to anime, and to Akira is certainly one film that's cited as a big influence on The Matrix.
Yeah.
But Star Wars, you know, even beyond the special effects and the technology, taking the idea of mythology and philosophy and whatnot and melding it into action cinema, that is what Star Wars kind of invented almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So that's two.
Yeah. A lot of people cite Jaws as the first blockbuster, which I don't think I really agree with. It's the first modern blockbuster, certainly, and Star Wars kind of solidified the format of the modern blockbuster. I mean, you know, blockbusters, the very first film ever made was a blockbuster because people paid through the nose to go and see it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, you know, all these films are blockbusters.
Yeah.
But certainly Jaws was the first modern blockbuster, and Lucas and Spielberg and De Palma and Coppola were all involved in that first wave of modern blockbuster creators. Yeah. And I think that it's interesting to see how Star Wars has given that kind of, more so even than The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but Star Wars, with its simple structure, with its sort of classical storytelling, bringing it into a new world, has created this whole sort of genre of, or this whole... set of genres which revolve around modern blockbusters, things like Terminator 2, like Jurassic Park, like Independence Day, like you know, Godzilla, like Armageddon. They're simple stories which have maybe been told 100 times before, but they're transmuted into a different world, or at least they're given a different spin.
Absolutely.
Like, for example, Independence Day is basically a modern version of War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Star Wars does. It's a modern version of The Hidden Fortress. It's a modern version of even, you know, sort of Robin Hood or Alibaba and the 40 Thieves.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of classic story turned into something else, which has happened so much since then.
Since then, yeah, absolutely. With varying degrees of success.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's responsible for a lot of dross as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the first negative points is, what has Star Wars brought to Hollywood? Star Wars clones.
Yes, absolutely.
And not just Star Wars movies with clone in the title.
Of course.
I want to be clear. There's a distinction.
There's a film came out, I think it was in 1999, called Wing Commander, based on the Wing Commander computer games.
Yeah.
And it is just an unashamed Star Wars clone. There's bits of Star Wars in it. There's bits of Battlestar Galactica. You know, there's bits of loads of different things. And it is literally one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
It's
but...
absolutely dreadful. The trailer looked really good when I was, you know, 16.
Yeah.
But no, dreadful, dreadful, dreadful film on all levels. And it's because of George Lucas that happened.
Yeah.
indirectly, you know.
Yeah, so
Wild Wild West, you know, that's another one.
Yeah, again, it's sort of... Yeah, I mean, well, really, I mean, I suppose the nutshell to the legacy of Star Wars in Hollywood is, like you say, it's sort of, along with Spielberg and stuff like Jaws, but Star Wars, you're right, it solidified the format and the style of the modern blockbuster. And therefore, its track record is 50% brilliant and 50%.
It kind of introduced an amoral footprint over the whole of the industry, and it's up to, you know, Stephen Sommers to make Van Helsing. It's not up to George Lucas to ruin things. It's up to the people who use his invention.
Sort of, it set the stage for films like The Matrix to come out, and set the stage for films like Van Helsing to come out, like Michael Bay's Transformers to come out, you know, things like that. I think they all owe something to Star Wars. Mm-hmm. So as such, Star Wars gets a wee bit of the blame or a wee bit of the credit, but obviously, ultimately, as I say, we're not going to blame George for Van Helsing.
No, of course. So that's going a bit too far.
Nor are we going to pat him on the back for The Matrix.
Nothing that George has ever done is as bad as Van Helsing.
Nothing that anyone has ever done is as bad as Van Helsing, to be fair.
Hitler.
Well, yeah, okay, sorry. I meant anyone in the world of cinema.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. I would have come off looking really bad if I go, no, actually.
Well, no, I think that.
Yeah, you know, we need to draw a line somewhere,
Yeah. Well, I think if Hitler had made a film about vampire hunters, it would have been Van Helsing.
It probably would have been better, to be honest.
If you could distill the evil that the Nazis had onto celluloid, it would look like Van Helsing.
Yeah, but see, at least the Nazis had a good main villain. Van Helsing didn't.
You're saying you'd like to see Van Helsing versus Hitler? You think that would make a better film? If Van Helsing had stormed into the Third Reich and just...
I think Hitler's more of a credible threat than the version of Dracula
I agree, a credible threat in the sense that he was actually a threat to millions and millions and millions of people.
As opposed to just a threat to your entertainment level.
Indeed,
which
mental stability.
Yeah.
More than entertainment, it's a way of life.
Yeah.
And to spew that crud out onto the
turgid screen. So, I think... that kind of sums up, I think, the pros and the cons.
Yeah.
Really, as we said, you know. But, yeah.
So looking back at the influences on Star Wars, sort of the specific influences, one of the films that I would definitely suggest that any Star Wars fan would go and see is The Hidden Fortress, which is basically the film that it is based on.
Yeah.
It actually started out, I mean, Akira Kurosawa, Japanese filmmaker, I only got into him through Star Wars. I can't claim to be some kind of great cineast. Like, you know, it was Star Wars that got me into that kind of classical Japanese cinema. And the films that he made in the 50s were sort of Jidaigeki, which is a period drama. But yeah. They weren't dramas. They were entertaining films for entertainment. You know, they don't teach you anything about the samurai. They show the samurai as, you know, badasses, yeah, in the same way that Henry Ford and, you know, sort of Sturgis, what's his name? John Sturgis, yeah, the Western filmmakers of the 50s, yeah, they didn't teach you about the Old West. They just showed you badass cowboys.
Yeah.
And Akira Kurosawa did the same for Samurai. You know, he wasn't making informational documentaries. He was making cool films that people would like. And he, yeah, was very much influenced by the Westerns that would later go on to be influenced by him.
Yeah.
And he was making Samurai films like Westerns. And like the Seven Samurai became the Magnificent Seven. And however good a film the Magnificent Seven is, the Seven Samurai is better.
Yeah.
Yojimbo went on to become A Fistful of Dollars. Now, I love Sergio Leone, and I think A Fistful of Dollars is one of the finest Westerns ever made. And The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as well. But A Fistful of Dollars, you know, is one of the greatest Westerns.
Yeah.
It's still not as good as Yojimbo. So Akira Kurosawa was an amazing filmmaker, and he made The Hidden Fortress, which George Lucas, after being turned down by De Laurentiis for Flash Gordon, yeah, and then going through various drafts of his story, he eventually went to The Hidden Fortress for his inspiration for the story, to simplify his story away from this huge involving epic that would have just, you know, been too busy on screen.
Yeah.
And it was the threat of legal ramifications from Kurosawa's sort of representatives in America which made George Lucas change a lot of the story. And it then became less of a remake of The Hidden Fortress and more of its own thing. But there's still an awful lot there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the line when the Imperial officer is saying, you know, your devotion to that ancient religion hasn't given you enough clairvoyance to, yeah, find the rebels' hidden fortress. And he doesn't finish, yeah, the line, you know, yeah, because it's a sort of a sly gag there. But The Hidden Fortress, basically, it follows the story of these two peasants who in Star Wars are C-3PO and R2-D2, the,
right,
lowest of the low,
yeah,
you know, droids. There's no lower thing, and there's no, yeah, lower thing than
peasants.
Not
allowed in the bar. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So it's these two peasants who basically are on the run from a civil war.
Yeah.
And they meet up with this sort of good-looking ruffian,
yeah,
who is Han Solo, and this willful young princess who is Princess Leia.
Yeah.
And the ruffian becomes kind of Han Solo and Obi-Wan Kenobi. If you can imagine a merging of both those characters,
yeah,
that's
prequel
Tashira Mifune.
No, not quite, I suppose.
He's more badass than that.
Yeah.
So he's kind of that character, and the princess is Princess Leia and Luke at the same time.
Right, got you.
And the bad guy general is kind of Darth Vader and Lando Calrissian at the same time. You know, there's a lot of parallels that have been split up into,
yeah,
more sort of fairy tale tropes. But it's all there, you know, it's all kind of there. There's gold hidden in sticks, and that becomes Han Solo's reward. There's a hidden,
yeah,
fortress in the mountains, and that becomes Yavin. You,
yeah,
know, there's a battle on horseback, which becomes the X-Wings. There's a lot there that is really... It's still in Star Wars, this DNA from this Japanese classic. So I really would recommend going to see Hidden Fortress, because it is a good film. You know, they're old films, they're in Japanese, so you've got subtitles, they're in black and white, they're from the mid-50s, but they're still as exciting... Listen to this, Michael Bay. They're still as exciting as any films you get today,
yeah,
because they have good actors in them. Again, they're not playing real people.
Yeah,
it's action cinema. They're,
yeah,
playing heightened characters like Bruce Willis does in Die Hard. He's not a real,
yeah,
policeman. He's a heightened policeman.
Yeah,
and these are the same. They're heightened characters, but they're still acted well. They're written well. They're performed well. They're shot well. They're edited well together. The action's exciting. I don't know what it is with Japanese actors. They must all just have to take swordplay at drama school or something.
Yeah.
They all seem to be fantastic, you know, swordsmen. So yeah, that's one film that I would definitely recommend. Go and see, or, you know, buy or rent or get it wherever you can. It's an absolutely fantastic film. Any of the Akira Kurosawa sort of period films are great for that kind of thing. And his modern dramas are also really, really well done as well. He was a master filmmaker, equally as good as anything you'd get in Hollywood. And he was unusual in Japanese cinema for being influenced by Hollywood. He was one of the first people to sort of take the influence of the West and apply it to Japanese cinema. And that's maybe why he's so popular in the West, because we see so many of the things that we grew up with.
Maybe more accessible
in his
to
films.
Someone that grew
up
in our,
absolutely. Yeah. You've also got the Flash Gordon and the Buck Rogers serials of the 30s, which were released on DVD just after Phantom Menace came out, and there was a whole sort of George Lucas went back on the sort of the publicity trail saying how he'd been, you know, influenced by all these things, and they all came on DVD, and I bought them because, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan, and they really are. I mean, they are cheesy.
Yeah.
And they are terribly written and badly acted. Buster Crabbe, you know, would never go off to play Stanley in The Streetcar Named Desire. you know, it's definitely a product of its time and of its genre. They're B-movies or B-movie sort of serials. But visually, in terms of using science fiction to tell the story, they're fantastic. The rockets, you can see the strings and you can see that the engines are made of basically fireworks or streamers, you know. But they look really good and they're stylish. And, you know, this guy comes in and he's like, I am the king of the lion men. And he's just a guy with a big beard. Yeah. But it's fun, you know. There's a lot of charm to it and there's a lot of excitement to it. And Ming the Merciless is kind of the template for virtually every slimy villain since.
Yeah.
And he's fantastically done in the serial. And a lot of the sort of every episode you get the story so far, and it's done in the style of a Star Wars crawl. That's where he got the Star Wars crawl from. And a lot of the sort of the communicators and the sort of the big screens, they're all sort of ferried over into Star Wars. So he's taken the sort of the storytelling aspects of Kurosawa and the visual aspects of Flash Gordon, and he's kind of merged them together. That's kind of those are the two big ones, the two big influences on Star Wars.
Absolutely.
So I'd thoroughly recommend digging out, you know, both of those things. Buster Crabbe's Flash Gordon and Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress.
Hidden Fortress, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Sorry, that's a very long rant of mine.
No, that's good, though. It's important stuff. See, this is the stuff I only have a vague, you know, kind of...
Uh-huh, yeah.
This is stuff I didn't know pre-Benji. So it's good to know, but... do you want to move on to came after the prequels, the TV series and so on?
The Many Crimes of George Lucas.
The Many Crimes of George Lucas, as they're also known. I think, to be fair, we'll need to proceed this, but there's a lot in here to love as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there's just also a lot to hate.
Yeah. Again, you know, up until 1997, George Lucas, in my eyes, could do no wrong. I loved everything he did, with the possible exception of Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
Which I still liked as a kid. and what we're about to say, even though we will be sort of listing things that we don't like about his later work, it's still important to note that we are still avid Star Wars fans.
Yes.
And we don't really hate him. We wouldn't be thinking about it in this much detail if we didn't like
exactly.
them.
Exactly. I think that's one of the most important things to say when you're talking about Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because, you know, fanboys of anything can be rabid.
Absolutely.
And, Star Wars fanboys even more so. I mean, it's the archetypal fanboy is the Star Wars fanboy. You know? And we all, to a man, get really, really angry about the things in the prequels, but we wouldn't if it weren't for the fact that the originals were so beloved.
It's
the backhanded compliment of
even the prequels, though they are such a gulf in quality between the originals and the prequels, they're still better than a lot of dross that is being made today.
I'll take the prequels over many of the Star Wars clones. You know,
yes, absolutely. I'll take them over Transformers 2. I'll take them over Van Helsing. I'll take them over The Mummy Returns. I'll take them over, you know, Wild Wild West, Men in Black 2.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of big films out there that the Star Wars prequels are superior to. It's just when you compare them to their parents,
absolutely,
that they are not as...
And that comparison, of course, you know, it's inevitable because it's part of the same series.
You know? And, you know, it's not we're not like Trekkies. Yeah. We don't just take whatever's given to us and say it's fantastic. We don't just eat crap and call it lasagna, you know.
Yeah. Have we just ignited an age-old war?
Maybe we have, I don't know. But I always find that, because I used to be a big Star Trek fan. When I was younger, I'd come home from school and I'd watch The Next Generation and I'd watch, you know, Patrick Stewart be amazing in this sort of, like, what was essentially, you know, a big budget sci-fi TV series, but it seemed like so much more. There was it made me think about things, about philosophy, about life, about people. And then you had DS9, which was, you know, again, quite decent.
Yeah.
And it certainly got better sort of towards the middle of the run, where it had the wars and it had the story arcs. It was exciting.
Yeah.
And then you had Voyager with a pan-faced old trout trying to order around a crew of hateful people.
I really hate Voyager.
There's only really two characters in that show which I had any time for. And one of them was Neelix.
Yeah, Neelix.
Who was
fun.
The cook.
Could have done with Neelix getting like
his own spin-off.
Or just turning up in DS9, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like Kes as well. I thought Jennifer Lee Ennis Kes was fantastic. Yeah. She's not had the career that I wanted her to have, because she was, you know, both a very sort of soulful kind of actress, not a brilliant actress. In, you know, you can't be brilliant in a sci-fi TV series. There's not enough meat in there for you. But she had a very soulful quality, and she was very, very pretty as well.
Yeah.
And I also quite like Tuvok.
Yeah, Tuvok's
the Vulcan.
Cool.
I think any time you get a Vulcan in there...
I think every Star Trek series, the Vulcans in it are cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or at least the main Vulcan
and
is cool.
It annoys me that Star Trek's been kind of vindicated now, because you had Voyager, which a lot of people liked. Like I say, they could be fed, you know, turd and be called, you know, call it.
Lasagna.
Yeah. And then they had Enterprise, which I think was better than Voyager, in the sense that Scott Bakula's a better actor.
I love Scott Bakula.
The cast hung together better.
He's far and away my favourite thing about Enterprise.
It was kind of more, because it was set nearer to the present time, it was kind of more gritty, more realistic. And it had a lot of flaws with it, you know, they didn't do with it what they should have done with it. But it was very, very, very flawed, but still reasonably enjoyable on an episode-to-episode basis. But then, in 2009, we got J.J. Abrams remaking, well not remaking, but doing this alternate universe Star Trek
reboot slash sequel slash prequel.
It's a sequel slash spin-off. I think you can't call it a reboot, because it's not a reboot, because it sticks too close to the original to be a reboot. So it's a sequel slash spin-off. It's a sequel to the Spock character, and it's a spin-off to the rest of the universe. And it made Star Trek cool again. You know, you're no longer looked at with derision for saying I like Star Trek. Cause they go, the one with the guy from Heroes. Yeah, I like Star Trek as well.
Yeah.
And you're like, no. From the 60s. You know, who stole Spock's brain and all that.
I tell you, in a roundabout way, because we've gone off on a bit of a tangent here, but we're about to hook back in, because I tell you one thing that Enterprise did, one failing for Enterprise.
Go on.
That at least Phantom Menace, but I would argue the other two as well, the Star Wars prequels share, is that Enterprise is set pre the original series.
Yes.
And yet everything looks better.
Yes.
The Enterprise, they tried to make it's all blocky and big and it's not slender, but... they couldn't get around. It's not just the special effects have come a long way. They just couldn't help. But the aesthetic of the Enterprise looks a lot more attractive.
Yes.
Than
it's more detailed, because cameras pick up better things. Lenses are better made than they were in the 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, the costumes are better because textiles have advanced. Yeah. You know, the special effects are better. The props are better because prop making's advanced. All these various sundry sort of things have been improved.
Yeah.
And it does. It jars when you think, well, this is... And I think it's less unforgivable in Star Wars, because when we come to the beginning of Episode 4... We're coming to the end of a regime of terror.
Yeah.
If you look at Afghanistan now and Afghanistan in the early 70s, it's the same thing. In the early 70s, it was a civilized, you know, culture of peaceful, wonderful, you know, it's a great country to be in, you know. And then the Taliban took control.
Yeah.
And it's now essentially a desert full of...
Yeah.
You know, gunfire and bombs.
Yeah, it used to be Coruscant, now it's Tatooine.
I've pretty lost our Afghani audience there.
Yeah.
But yes, basically
we've offended everyone else. Aye. We might as well go
In the sense of equality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's more forgivable in Star Wars because mercifully the storyline was such that the prequels were always going to be shinier because they'd written in that this was a time of peace.
Yeah, it can respond to and it can echo real world situations in that way that great cinema can.
Absolutely. But let's go charging into the prequels.
I say planning, we don't have a very sort of solid plan beyond the end of season two, except that we know that we're going to carry this on as long as we can, you know, as long as people Well, even beyond when people stop listening, we'll keep doing it.
For ourselves,
yeah. And we do plan to do a Star Wars prequel box set special at some point in the future. And it will be a lot less praise-filled than the original trilogy one was. But it will be hopefully fair and balanced, and we'll talk about what we liked about the films as well as what we didn't like. So right now we're talking about it specifically in relation to the original trilogy to being a child of the original franchise. So we're going to cover it in slight detail here, but we will have a more in-depth thing later on. So if it seems like we're being negative, hold on till the proper box set. Aren't they rubbish? Aren't they absolutely rubbish?
They really are.
I tell you, the moment when I grew up, the moment when I became an adult and I realized that things weren't always the way I wanted them to be. It was nothing to do with real life. It was nothing to do with leaving school and going to college. It was nothing to do with having my heart broken for the first time. It was nothing to do with sort of, you know, being on Job Seeker's allowance, trying to find work and whatnot. It was when I sat in that cinema and I watched Darth Vader go yippee. It was with that one word that it's like I walked into the cinema a boy and I came out a man.
Childhood end.
That was it. It was that one word. Because I'd seen this amazing, what I thought at the time was an amazing lightsaber battle between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon and this huge army of droids.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. They were slicing up battle droids and they were kind of a bit silly battle droids going Roger, Roger and all this kind of stuff. It's kind of rubbish. But they were awesome. They were doing what Jedi had always dreamed that they could do.
Yeah.
You know, they were going fast and they were leaping and they were swizzling the lightsabers around.
Yeah.
And the choreography. Nick Gillard, you know, I don't think he's a patch on the guy that did the original trilogy. I can't remember his name. But he's a very good choreographer.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand actors, obviously, but he understands choreography very, very well.
Yeah.
Then you see Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, okay, well, I see him in the trailer. You know, I know he's there. He's a little bit annoying, but, you know, fair enough. He's a new character. I'm sure, the argument is that the kids like him, which is annoys me.
Yeah.
And that was fine. I didn't mind Jar Jar. I mean, I did after the film. I hated Jar Jar.
Yeah.
But now in my wizened older years, I don't mind Jar Jar so much. I don't think he belongs in the Star Wars universe.
He's kind of become the symbol of, you know, what's wrong with the
prequels. And unfairly so.
He's far and away not the... You can't sum up the problem through Jar Jar.
Absolutely.
He's not even among the worst of the problems.
Yeah. No, not at all.
Yeah.
I agree that the Gungans make the Ewoks look like Shaft, and I think that, you know, Jar Jar is a problem, but he's not the problem. He shouldn't be the poster boy for the declining quality of Star Wars.
At the risk of referencing one of the poorer lines in the first film, we've got bigger fish to fry, to be honest, than Star Wars.
It was Jake Lloyd, and it was Anakin Skywalker. The fact that Anakin Skywalker's a 9-year-old boy, we don't ever need to see Anakin Skywalker being a 9-year-old boy.
No.
You know, Obi-Wan Kenobi specifically says in Star Wars, when I met your father, he was already a great pilot. You can't just throw him in a pod race.
Yeah.
Invent a pod race, basically, and then throw him in it and say, oh, look, he's fantastic. No, that's not the way it works.
Yeah, I think a lot of it came from... I don't know if this was his decision when writing it and when deciding what age Anakin should be in the prequel, or if it was just Lucas's justification after the event.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks about when they were settling on Anakin's age, and he says that he had to balance the realism of believing a child, even aided by the Force, could pilot these things. You know, so that made them skew slightly older, you know, making maybe 12, 15, you know. But then they wanted the trauma, the emotion of him having to go away and leave his mother, so they wanted to skew him younger, you know. But I said, if you wanted to get that in, you know what they could have done? They could have introduced a teenage Anakin and have him talk about it.
Yes.
Have a scene where he tells Obi-Wan or Padme
about leaving his mother when he was nine.
About leaving his mum.
Absolutely.
Maybe even have a flashback with no dialogue or something.
Absolutely.
You know, I'd have accepted that.
Yeah, you can't create something like saying, oh, Anakin leaving his mother is what sort of starts him on the path to the dark side.
Yeah.
And then build the whole story around it. It doesn't work. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No. You don't make your 9-year-old Anakin because you've said the mother thing, you take whatever the good age is. I'd have said 16. Yeah. I think a 21-year-old Obi-Wan, a 16-year-old Anakin, who is already a navigator on a spice freighter or something like that, and he's already kind of grumpy, he's already kind of surly. We can see that because the Jedi didn't find him early enough, he started on the path to the dark side. That could be why.
Too old. He is too old to begin training.
Exactly. Yeah. 9 years old, he's too old. Yeah. So then how old is Luke in Empire Strikes Back? He's like 22 or something. How can that possibly work?
And yet...
If age is that big a factor, he's more than... Oh, he's almost three times the age.
Yeah, if age is that big a factor, and last time we trained a 9-year-old, they turned into Darth Vader.
Yeah.
We're going to train a 22-year-old. What could possibly go wrong?
We'll train Darth Vader's son. That's fine. Yeah, no worries. Yeah. It's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense.
Just senile old Ewan McGregor said so.
Yeah. It's stupid. It's Kenobi a stupid, stupid story idea, and I don't like it. And it should have been changed. He should have been older. Forget the pod racing. Forget Tatooine. Forget bringing back every character you possibly can that doesn't require you to hire an actor. You know, we don't need R2-D2. I love R2-D2, but we don't need him. We don't need C-3PO. We don't need Jabba the Hutt.
Creates, that whole thing with... He explains that way in Sith by writing in that they wipe 3PO's mind.
Uh-huh.
But you wouldn't have needed to... You wouldn't have written yourself into that corner if you hadn't introduced 3PO. Or
absolutely.
At the very least, if you hadn't made... Anakin Skywalker builds him.
I know.
And then 30 years later... Well, no, a lot more than 30 years later, but... Luke Skywalker buys him. And, okay, 3PO's had his mind wiped, but R2 hasn't. Why is nobody going... Skywalker's a pretty common moniker on Tatooine,
It's not the Jones of the Star Wars universe, is it?
It's redonkulous.
It is redonkulous.
And I think you touched on something there. The thing that hurts you most in Episode One isn't Jar Jar, as many people claim.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the criminal waste of Darth Maul as a villain, who could have been a really awesome villain, not in Vader's League.
I don't think that Darth Maul was underused. I think if we'd had more of him, it would have lessened his impact. Yeah,
I think he's so much cooler than Count Dooku.
He
that
is
I'd
awesome.
Rather we I'd rather we had Dooku for one movie and Maul for two than the other way around.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, he's a very superficial character. He's not got depth.
There's something about him, the way Ray Park plays him. And Ray Park's not an actor, and I'm not saying that I love Ray Park as an actor, but as a stuntman, he's a phenomenal actor.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's really, really good. He should be taking on more action roles. He should be doing more films.
He's a much better actor than Arnold Schwarzenegger as a stuntman, that's for sure.
Absolutely, very, very much so.
The thing, though, that annoys you most, and I think annoys most of us most, certainly me as well, is that the worst character, the most annoying character in Episode One is Darth Vader.
Yes.
And yet in Episodes 4, 5, and 6, the best character...
Yes.
Boba Fett and the Emperor and Luke and Han be damned. The best character in the original trilogy, the symbol, the thing that's on posters everywhere, that people emulate, is Darth Vader.
Absolutely.
He is the boy. He is the daddy.
Yes.
And we have him distilled into, to be fair to Jake Lloyd, To be fair to child actors everywhere, they are kids. We can't expect the same things from them that we can expect from adults.
Okay.
Which is why the filmmakers shouldn't
make it. To throw sand in that argument's face, Haley Joel Osment. Okay,
he's
weird, but he was
Jake
a very,
Lloyd,
very good actor.
Yeah.
No, he was. He was great in The Sixth Sense.
I still wouldn't want to see him play a 9-year-old Darth Vader, though.
Spencer Tree Clark from Gladiator and Unbreakable, he's a very, very decent child actor. Now, this is something which nullifies that argument, and I presume you haven't seen this, which is why I don't think you can make this argument, right?
Okay.
If you watch the documentary called The Beginning on the Star Wars DVD, it's the making of, 3-hour making of. It's phenomenally interesting to watch for all the right and wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And they show you the casting process of Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah.
And now they boil it down to three kids in the end. One of them is terrible and should be ashamed of himself, even though he's 9.
Okay.
One of them is Jake Lloyd.
Okay.
The Antichrist of Star Wars. And one of them is this really, really decent child actor. He's really good. He's natural. He's understated. He's subtle. He reads the lines and he reads them well. And it shows you his audition, and you're like, oh, he's really good, yeah. What did he screw up to sort of lose the part? Yeah. And then Jake Lloyd comes in, and he reads it like a pantomime. You know, and admittedly, he's better than the first kid who was made of cardboard, yeah. But he's over the top with it, and he sort of goes over with his enunciation, and he exaggerates words he shouldn't exaggerate, and he rolls his eyes, and he does a lot of cute sort of eight-year-old face acting. And you're like, is this really working?
Yeah.
Is George Lucas that sort of... you know, dumb to acting that you're going to believe this blonde devil boy over the really decent actor that you've just seen? Then Jake Lloyd gets it. Now, Jake Lloyd had been in Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Is that the reason? Because he already had a film to his name. The reason he got it? Maybe he had a better agent. I don't know. But when you see the other kid who could have been Anakin Skywalker, and I'm not saying that this kid going yippee would have been fine. It wouldn't. It's still down to the script. But he's a much, much, much better actor than Jake Lloyd. And I bet now that they're both, you know, in their sort of early 20s, I bet he's better looking as well. Jake Lloyd's gone ugly. Real ugly. And bitter.
Good. I think that's hit the nail on the head, though. You know, Darth Vader goes from being the highlight of one trilogy to the biggest problem in the other.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the same with clones. We all came out of the cinema, Attack of the Clones, saying that boy they've got playing Darth Vader can't act for toffee.
Yes, absolutely.
I remember a mate of mine who shall remain nameless, but I know he listens to the podcast and he'll know who he is when I say this, said, but that's the point. He was told to... that's it. It's when I used to blame Lucas and he blamed the actor, Hayden Christensen. He said he was told to act cold and emotionless because that's the way Darth Vader's going to become, and he took it too literally, and I said blank. I said the director still gets to say cut, Hayden, could you do that again please, and actually act, you know. I said they're both to blame as far as I'm concerned. But
well,
I've kind of got
a point with your friend.
Yeah, he's your friend as well. I'll tell you who it is afterwards.
You wouldn't mention his name, but you've already called him blank, and
yeah, we'll call him blank.
Okay,
yeah.
that's his real name.
Yeah,
blank.
Sorry, blank.
So, yeah, no, he's got a point. I think that it is Hayden Christensen's fault for being a terrible actor, and I've seen him in things since. I've not seen Shattered Glass, which
is... meant to be very good in it.
I've heard that, but I'm not sure I believe it. Well, I think he's probably just better than Anakin, that's why. I've seen him in Jumper, and he's terrible. Maybe it's just blockbusters. Maybe he just needs, like, people watching him all the time. And in a drama, you can do that. You can watch your actors, but in a big-budget film, you need to watch your special effects guys as well. That's why your actors get away with being terrible.
Yeah.
But it is George Lucas's fault. Even if not for saying cut, you know, let's do that one again, because you might need to just do it over and over and over and over and over, and then
faster,
settle for
intense.
The best of a bad
faster,
bunch.
More intense.
But it's also his fault for hiring him in the first place.
Yeah.
He cast Hayden Christensen. He said, oh, he's got a James Dean quality about him. If you mean he looks a little bit like James Dean, then yes, he does. If you say his hair bouffants up the same way that James Dean's did, yes, he does. Yeah. He's not got the same quality as
him. No, absolutely.
He's not got the same... I mean, James Dean wasn't even a particularly good actor anyway. He was just charismatic, and he was kind of intense, and girls liked him in the 50s. You need a good actor.
I think the trouble maybe stems from, you know, could it be that George has never had to, or he's never had to sort of go far to find an actor to play Vader? When Vader's been played before, he's been played by a brilliant voice actor, by a bodybuilder, and by a stuntman. And that's it. He's not had anybody play the face. He's not had any, you know... The guys that were on the set interacting with the other actors weren't actors. They were either the stuntman, the choreographer / stuntman, or they were the Green Cross Code man. And they, you know, they were just taking direction. And then in this trilogy, he's got to cast Darth Vader, but he's got to use an actor, somebody who can do the voice and the face and the movement and so on. And he's just gone, I don't know how to do this.
Maybe it is.
I'm doing him a massive favour by saying that.
I think also he's just not a very good director.
No.
He's a great... you know, producer, like you say, a good ideas man, and you know,
absolutely.
he can
point
what
he's good at.
He can
he's
point
the
a camera in the
those
right
things.
He can point a camera in the right direction.
Yeah.
But when you take Natalie Portman, right?
Yeah.
Who I think is a little overrated as an actress.
Yeah, I think
she's
a fine
she's
actress,
good,
but
she's not
amazing. Yeah.
But when you see what she spews out in The Phantom Menace, she's really, really bad. And in Attack of the Clones, you think, how can any actor take this script with what seems to be no direction and make anything of it? And, you know, Ewan McGregor fares better because he's got a better character to play. You know, Obi-Wan Kenobi, he can use Alec Guinness as his role model, you know.
Yeah.
And Liam Neeson
does...
Just
as an aside, I would like to say Ewan McGregor is the best thing in the prequel trilogy actor-wise, I think.
Qui-Gon? No, he's not. He's not at all. No, he's not. He's the second best thing. Ian McDiarmid.
Ah, okay, yes.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yes.
He makes the
out of the new actors.
Okay, out of the new actors, Ewan McGregor's the best. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Followed
very
closely by Liam Neeson as Qui-Gon.
Absolutely.
But that's right, in your face, Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson. He's awesome. I'm glad he's in it because he's cool.
Yeah.
But he's not. He's not revolutionising.
Samuel L. Jackson in a robe with a lightsaber.
It's just him. Yeah,
it's what it is.
I wish he'd been allowed to swear because it would have been Jules, wouldn't it? You know, I've wandered long and far, and I've ended up here.
Have you seen that T-shirt? You've seen Jackie Brown.
Yes.
I'll not say the line, but there's a T-shirt, purple lightsaber. For when you absolutely, positively have to kill.
Yeah,
anyway.
Absolutely.
It's class.
So yeah, no, I think Ewan McGregor's great. But I think Natalie Portman is a good actress. She's done some really, really good stuff. And when you see what she does in Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, and to a lesser extent in Revenge of the Sith, although she's better in that.
She gets more to do in Sith, or more meaty stuff to do in Sith. Yeah,
It's amazing that, you know, that I mean, V for Vendetta. V for Vendetta is a blockbuster film directed by a music video director, written by the guys that, you know, based on a great comic book, but written by the guys that made the Matrix sequels. Yeah. And yet when you see what she does in that, she is phenomenal. Her and Hugo Weaving, in fact, the whole cast are brilliant in V for Vendetta. Yeah. It's a wonderful film. And then you see her in Star Wars and you're like, what on earth are you doing, little girl? It's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
I was really worried watching V for Vendetta because I can't remember if it was before or after Clones. Mm-hmm. I think it was after. It was definitely after.
It was during Revenge of the Sith.
Was it?
Yeah, because she had to come back to do reshoots. Oh, there's one scene in Revenge of the Sith where she looks really thin and sallow, and her face is all thin, and her eyes are all sunken in, and that's because she's lost a lot of weight for the torture scenes for V for Vendetta. Yeah,
and I was really worried watching V for Vendetta because I really wanted to see it. I was really excited. I liked the comic. I wanted to see the film, you know. And Hugo Weaving, I already loved from all three
Marvelous,
Matrix movies,
yeah.
you know. And I knew he was
and
be
Priscilla, Queen
v,
of the Desert.
And then, yeah, of course, yeah. So I was really excited about that, and I thought, you know what, even though he's in a mask, she's going to be acting opposite Hugo Weaving.
Yeah.
She's doomed. You know, I thought, the chick from Star Wars against the baddie from The Matrix, she doesn't stand a chance. And she does
Because she's the chick from Heat,
really
she's the chick from Leon.
Yeah.
You know,
she's
chick
not the
Morbus
chick from Star Wars.
Absolutely,
you know,
that's exactly it,
curse my ignorant young mind that hadn't gone back and watched all these greats yet, you know.
Yeah.
And, she's a lot better than... It's really annoying that her name is so off. Anyone that's been in a Star Wars movie, with possible exceptions of Liam Neeson and Ewan McGregor, guys that had built massive careers before.
Yeah, Alec Guinness, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Alec Guinness to our generation is Star
Wars,
but before our generation, he was everything. But
certainly anybody that was in the prequels, you know, if you see their name anywhere now, it's usually followed by, you know, parentheses, and it's got Star Wars in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame, I think, in Natalie Portman's case, because she's much better than that implies.
Yes.
Although she's still, as we've just said, she's still not an amazing actress. She doesn't blow my mind.
No.
But she's very, very good when... You know, when
do you know
rain to
what
be,
I think would help Natalie Portman to be a better actress?
What's that?
Nudity. She refuses to do nudity, and I think that gets in the way of her performances.
That's a very self-serving.
So, Natalie's agent, if you're listening.
Yeah. Mind you, have you seen Closer?
I have, yeah.
Close enough.
No.
No?
No. Because there's an awkwardness about it, which, you know, I find very unsexy.
Yeah.
What I want is more sort of Demi Moore in striptease, but played by Natalie Portman.
Okay.
That sort of self-assurance. Yeah. Maybe Showgirls 2.
Are you just saying that Showgirls 2 should happen to the world?
I think it already has, actually. I think that someone's made a Showgirls 2.
Have they?
Yeah, it's even worse than the first one. Which, you know, is nothing against Paul Verhoeven, because he's great, but yeah. Anyway, so off the beaten track.
Yes.
Where were we?
Natalie Portman is
and
good.
Before that, we were at Hayden Christensen. Being absolutely terrible.
Yes.
As Kevin Smith refers to him, Mannequin Skywalker.
Yeah, I love that.
I love that as well.
That's so funny. Oh.
Go and see Clerks 2. It's everything you need to know about Star Wars.
Absolutely. Well, no, Clerks and Clerks 2 between them is everything you need to know about Star Wars.
Well, Clerks 1 is the original trilogy. Yeah, they reference that in a wonderful way.
The construction workers on the Death Star, and then,
So I think there's that about it. There's the poor acting, there's the poor characterization, there's the poor storytelling as well, you know. Whereas Star Wars was a very simply told fairy tale with a lot of sort of, like, you know, sci-fi accoutrement. And The Empire Strikes Back was much more in depth. It was much more character driven. It was about, you know, who self-identity, and about fathers and sons, and about, you know, how far are you willing to go to save what you know is right when it's someone there's a real complexity to it.
Yeah.
And all the character interactions. Return of the Jedi goes back to the simplicity a little bit, yeah, while also staying very much with the father-son kind of thing.
And we get this sort of the fantastic cap to the trilogy.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it kind of becomes Darth Vader's movie. It's about do I follow this guy who has been my boss and my mentor for so long, or do I save my son?
Yeah.
And it's a real, there's depth there to it. And the prequels don't have that.
No.
It's, I'm a whiny little bitch.
Yep.
I can't get the girl I want because her skin is not like sand. and I'm going to turn into Darth Vader.
Yeah.
All the motivations for the characters are terrible. You know, I'm going to become, I'm going to slaughter all the people that I know because I want to save my wife from dying. No.
Yeah. It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. It's not a strong enough thing. Now, what happened in some of the comic books, some of the Star Wars comic books, which I think would have been better, is a much slower, more gradual progression into the dark side, where maybe over the course of the three films, he is slowly, you get a few scenes in each film where he is shown things by Palpatine.
Yeah.
And it gives him that sort of sense of,
yeah,
rather than being a whiny, moany little, you know, 9-year-old in a 20-year-old's body.
Do you know what bothers me is, you mentioned slow and gradual, mm-hmm, and that's the way it should have been. It feels very, he's angelic almost. I mean, obviously we hate Jake Lloyd, but you know, the way that the character is meant to be seen in the first film, you know.
Yeah.
There's not a hint, he's sad about leaving his mum.
Yeah, but he's cherubic.
But yeah, there's not a hint of darkness or anger or anything about him in the first film.
Yeah.
Then in the second film, we have the whole thing with his mum and the slaughtering the sand people.
Yes.
And it feels like a sledgehammer to the face. It comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, before that, he's a stroppy teenager.
Yeah.
Which, again, is not a good excuse for going to the dark side.
If we'd met the stroppy teenager in the first one, and then things slowly started happening to him, you know, as bad things started happening to him slowly personally, whilst Palpatine was showing him interesting things, and... Yeah, like you said, stagger it across the trilogy.
Absolutely.
Don't do nothing until the middle of the second one, and then go hell for leather in the third one.
Yes.
You know? And that's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah.
So there's so that's kind of the legacy.
Yeah.
So we've already touched on, I think, many of the crimes of George Lucas.
Yeah.
The Gungans, Jar Jar Binks, Jake Lloyd as Anakin Skywalker. Anakin Skywalker saying yippee.
Anakin Skywalker in general.
Yeah.
The end of Jedi.
Sebastian Shaw is a fantastic Anakin.
Yeah.
If anything, they should have got Sebastian Shaw, who regrettably passed away in the '90s.
Yeah.
And got him. Maybe sort of digitized his younger face onto
done an X-Men 3 on him.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Do you know what I'd have loved is if we got the prequels re-released where they've digitally replaced Hayden Christensen with Sebastian Shaw?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Get your own back, kind of. I'd love that.
Yeah. Another, we've also got this idea that, you know, sort of bringing all these old characters that we love, Yoda, Chewbacca. Yeah. I mean, you need Yoda. You need Obi-Wan. You need Vader, and that's basically it.
You need the main Jedi and the main Sith from the original trilogy to appear or be referenced in some way in the prequels.
The Emperor, you know, sort of Palpatine
Of course, yeah.
You need Obi-Wan, you need Yoda, you need Vader. You don't need anybody else. You don't need 3PO. You don't need R2. You don't need Chewbacca. Han Solo was going to be in Revenge of the Sith, which would have been just one character too far.
Too far, that would have been abysmal,
There's bringing all these in, it just makes it lazy. It's lazy storytelling. It's a way of sort of creating a shortcut for the audience, and it negatively affects the story.
Ironically, as well, you know, instead of bringing back R2 and 3PO, they could have introduced some new characters and sold more toys.
Absolutely,
they could have sold new toys.
Well, I mean, they bring C-3PO, but he's a different color, so you can't just use your gold 3PO when playing Attack of the Clones. You need to buy the silver 3PO.
Yeah, and of course we need the. You don't want to play with that R2, not yet.
No,
you
not
the one that still has rockets in him.
Not the pop-out lightsaber R2 from Return of the Jedi. Buy a rocket lightsaber. Yeah.
Which, again, going back to the Star Trek Enterprise, everything looks shinier even though it's a past thing.
Yeah.
Not so much everything, it's a past. But what happens to R2 that he loses his rockets between movies?
Absolutely.
I'm not saying that I need a scene in either the prequels or the original trilogy explaining where the rockets are. We could have just not put them in.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the first one, but if you're going to put them in. And that's what bothers me is sort of I talked about the mind wipe thing. They write these things in knowing that they're going to have to explain it before episode 4 happens. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, such as R2's boosters and R2's memory, they don't explain it, you know.
No.
And in other cases, such as 3PO's memory, they do.
Yeah.
But it's like, why write yourself into that corner, George?
I know.
You could have just written a movie where it didn't happen, and it would have flitted into. And X-Men Origins did it as well. Prequel writers just need to sit down and watch the original film that you're going to feed into.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's a quote from Hugh Jackman that was going around when Wolverine was coming out. He was doing the rounds saying, I really wanted to feel like he walked off the... he walks out of the last scene of Wolverine into that bar from the start of X-Men 1. Well, he doesn't, Hugh. He doesn't. Because you went, your writers went to the George Lucas School of prequel writing.
Yeah.
And
here's one thing. There is nothing...
Yeah,
with the possible exception of Jake Lloyd, there is nothing in the Star Wars prequels which are as bad as the adamantium bullets in terms of a bad idea.
Absolutely.
We'll save that for another podcast.
Yeah, that's another argument
for
another day. There's a lot of material out of Wolverine. Yeah.
So I tell you, another thing that is could be counted as a sin of George Lucas, or one of the many crimes of George Lucas, is the way that he's been very willy-nilly with the licensing of Star Wars.
Yeah.
You had Star Wars, which is great. Mm-hmm. Then you had the Star Wars Holiday Special, which I think Lucas actually wrote a lot of, which was absolute just pish.
This was just delivered by hand. Solo. Oh.
Yeah. Terrible. No. I'll tell you, the only good thing about that is the animated segment in the middle where you meet Boba Fett.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
A kind of kick-ass cartoon.
Even though he's inexplicably really pally with Luke by the end of it.
Well, no, he's not, though. It's a trick.
Oh, yeah.
It's a trick. It's well-written. It's good. It fits in. It fits in with the Star Wars canon. I think it's done by the same guys that went on to do Droids and Ewoks. It has that feel to it.
I loved Ewoks when I was
Yeah, old. I did as well.
Oh, it's so good.
But then you've got Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, and then you've got all the books and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I read Splinter a few of the books.
Splinter Mind's Eye.
Splinter Mind's Eye. That was actually quite a good book.
Yeah.
And it was written because... he didn't know whether Star Wars would be a success at the time, and he wanted a low-budget sequel idea. So Alan Dean Foster wrote it, set on a swampy planet where you wouldn't have to build a lot of sets, and there's only a few characters, and Han Solo's not there because he hadn't got a contract for Harrison Ford. So that's quite a good book. And then you had this trilogy of books called The Heir to the Empire trilogy by an author called Timothy Zahn. Yeah.
Those were the first ones
they
I
were
read
the first,
and they expanded.
They were, yeah. And I loved them. They were really, really good books.
Yeah.
And they were the first kind of canon books as
episode
well.
Episode 7, 8 and 9.
They could well have been. And they introduced a whole host of stuff. A lot of stuff which had been developed for the Star Wars role-playing game, which is another license that Lucas sold. Now, I never really played the role-playing game, but I had a few of the books because I liked reading the background on some of the characters and stuff when I was a kid. And it was absolutely wonderful. It was marvellous. But then you go off into this whole other world of computer games and toys and other books and books by different people written at the same time, and the characters do things and killing off Chewbacca and you know, introducing this character Mara Jade from the Heir to the Empire books, who you then go to play in Mysteries of the Sith, who's a fantastic character, and then you go off and kill her off as well. It's just like, you know, who are you licensing this for? Who are you licensing it to? And then the prequels come out and they contradict a whole lot of the stuff that you've been reading for the past however many years. And like I say, I never read a lot of the books, but I read a few of them, and the ones that I did read, I quite enjoyed. And then to find out that none of them actually happened because George Lucas changed them when he wrote the prequels.
Yeah.
Either, you know, pay an interest in your own franchise, George, or don't license it out so you've finished working on it.
If you're going to be precious about it, absolutely. Because, I mean, he's apparently, I don't know how true this is, but apparently after Chewie was killed off, Lucas went a bit mental. Not a bit mental. I mean, he was angry. He was annoyed that
I don't think he would have done, because he agreed it. He must have agreed it in the first place.
Well, apparently he didn't. Sort of, he licensed the books or something, but he didn't know.
He didn't read the details.
Or something like that. And there was a reshuffling after Chewie was killed off. Now, this might just be urban legend. I heard it from someone who heard it from someone who heard it from someone. You know. And there was a reshuffling of how the way the books were worked and the plot, and everything had to go through Lucas's desk and be approved,
right?
So that couldn't happen to him again.
Okay.
Now my argument is, if you're gonna license and expand it, he should have done that from day one.
Yes.
Or he should have, as you said, when he was writing the prequels, he should have bowed to the, you know, he should have written within the restrictions of the canon.
Absolutely.
That was created.
I mean, you know, you could just pull the big retcon lever. You could press the plot contrivance device and bring Chewie back. That's what I think.
The USS Deus Ex Machina.
Absolutely.
We need you again.
We beamed him up at the last minute. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. But, so that again, is it's sort of... Again, it creates a sort of, it's an impression of a kind of a blasé kind of attitude, or like he's sort of, you know, run around, play in my yard, you know, tell all these stories, and then, you know, he sits on his ass for 30 years, and then, right now, I'm pulling the rug out.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of...
Play in my yard, do what you like. You broke my Chewie toy.
And it's sort of, and you know, with the prequels coming along and contradicting so much, it's like, well, if you knew you were going to do that, George, you've been telling us from day one that Vader was always Luke's dad, which we know he wasn't.
Now, this brings me on to my next of the many crimes of George Lucas are the lies around the story. It started out as a remake of The Hidden Fortress, okay? Yeah. Obviously, we just because it didn't start out that way, but the film that was made was basically a remake of The Hidden Fortress. He had no idea. He had no idea Luke and Leia were sisters. He had no idea that Vader was the father. He had no idea. When he came to start writing The Empire Strikes Back, it was basically a blank page. Yeah. He knew that he'd done it in the style of a serial.
Yeah.
He'd referenced Anakin Skywalker, he'd referenced the Clone Wars, he knew there was background, and he knew that there was stuff going on because he kept Vader alive, and he didn't kill
the
Emperor.
That's a very deliberate decision.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He talked about Jabba the Hutt and how Han owed Jabba the Hutt money, and he had... There's a lot of stuff going on before and since that insinuated he knew that things were going to happen, and he had Alan Dean Foster write Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which would become then the Star Wars sequel if he didn't have a budget to make a big film.
And they're in... The Luke and Leia love scene in Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
Absolutely.
That just underlines, you know, he knew that was in the book, therefore he hadn't decided Luke and Leia were brother and sister.
Absolutely.
Or he's sick.
They fight Vader at one point. Yeah. Hey, maybe he is a bit sick. I don't know. Maybe he's just really into his incest.
That's an avenue we'd better not go
maybe down. Not, yeah.
That'll get us sued.
The Lucas lawyers will come down like a pack of TIE fighters, they will.
Yeah.
Then they have the fight with Darth Vader as well.
Yeah.
And you're like, well... Isn't this the point when Vader would say, I'm your father, and he doesn't, so what's going on?
I'm your father, she's your sister, stay away, you dirty pervert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's the lies. And then he goes on to say, oh, I had this idea all along, and blah, 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 and I knew what it was going to be, and I knew all that. Yeah. No, rubbish. Absolute rubbish. I don't think he had any idea what the prequels were going to be, except Anakin becomes Vader.
Yeah.
And that's after Return of the Jedi.
The Clone Wars...
And the Clone Wars, you mentioned the Clone Wars.
At some point, but,
He knew that Anakin and Obi-Wan fought together in the Clone Wars and that Vader killed Anakin. Then he decided that Anakin was Vader and that was it. That was all he had.
So what I told you was true from a certain point of view.
So he didn't have Padme, he didn't have the droids, he didn't have the Trade Federation, he didn't have taxation or roots or anything like that. It was all just made up. And he goes on and on and on about how he had them all. And I had this sort of book in the mid-90s. It was actually a CD-ROM, and it had in it this document from George Lucas where he said, the Star Wars trilogy is the middle trilogy of a 9-part story.
Yeah.
This is a quote in a Lucasfilm property by George Lucas. It's the middle of a 9-part series. This is 1995.
Yeah.
The upcoming episode one, he says, is the beginning of a new trilogy, and then we'll carry on. He didn't actually carry on, but he said, you know, 7, 8, and 9 take place afterwards.
Yeah.
He then goes on to say, actually, Star Wars is the story of Anakin Skywalker, and it finishes at the end of number 6. Well, what were you talking about 7, 8, and 9 for then, George? Yeah, did you think we'd just forget? Did you think that we are Trekkies and we will obey your word?
We will accept it all.
It's ridiculous.
Oh.
Lies. So that is one of the major crimes, actually, is the lies. If he'd said, I was written into a corner with Empire Strikes Back, and suddenly I thought, wouldn't this be a great conceit? It becomes, and you could even reference it being, you know, Uther Pendragon and Arthur Pendragon, or Morgana Le Fay, and how, you know, family betrays family and stuff, and you could sort of reference it back to that. I'm sure there's Japanese myths, I'm sure there's African myths, I'm sure there's, you know, sort of European myths where this happens. Tristan and Isolde, I think. Tristan steals Isolde off his own father, you know. So there's father-son issues all along. And he could have said, well, in writing the sequel, I decided to incorporate this and it would make... Fine. We don't mind. Brilliant. Great. We like it. Don't say it was an idea all along. And then, you know, if you've already thought that Luke and Leia were in love, don't make Luke feel jealous at Han in the first film, and B, don't make him snog on Hoth.
Yeah.
It's just wrong.
Yeah.
Although Luke is from a farm planet, so I suppose it wouldn't really be.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, moving swiftly on. But yeah, no, it is just annoying. And the thing I can't get past is Vader in number 4. We've talked about, you know, how awesome he is. He's a brilliant villain. He's a great threat. But he is essentially the muscle. You know,
he's the henchman.
Yeah, he's the main antagonist of the film, but he's not the main man in the Empire.
No.
The Emperor is.
Uh-huh.
And he's not the main the main man even in the movie, because although the Emperor's off screen, Grand Moff Tarkin's running the show.
Yeah, he's the mastermind, and Vader is the instrument of his will.
So to then say this is his story and it's always been his story. So, no, I think you'll find he's a main character for 5 of the movies, George, but in the movie in which you introduced him, he's just a thug.
See, I can kind of... I see what you mean in terms of Star Wars.
Yeah.
In terms of saying it's always been about him, it's wrong because it's not. But when you retcon it with the 6 films, it does kind of make sense.
Yeah, it's not as glaring as all
that. Because it's not until Luke Skywalker arrives that Vader then has drive and purpose.
Yeah.
He's happy to be a lackey because he has no purpose until he realizes his son's there, and with father and son they could overthrow the emperor.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite clever that he's retconned that. But I agree with you; it is very, very clear that could not have been his intention from the start.
From the first film, yeah.
Absolutely. And when you look at the earlier drafts of the screenplay, there's none of that in there.
Yeah.
None of that. Vader is the father. The father turned bad. None at all. The father's in it, and he gets killed.
Yeah.
You know. So when Obi-Wan says, "Darth Vader killed your father." That's a literal reference to a past screenplay, yeah. So it's true from any point of view.
Yeah.
So there's the lies. And then he goes on to say, you know, and this is one thing that I've said before that I will say till the day he retracts it. He says, oh, yeah, the Star Wars films are always meant to be kids' films. And you're like, yeah, you know, kids love those trade routes, George.
Yeah.
If kids, there's one thing that kids can't get enough of, it's council disputes and tax routes.
Yeah.
That's one thing that kids really like. And that scene in Revenge of the Sith, you know, when Darth Vader's burning and his face is all scalding and he's had his arms cut off by his best friend, kids love that.
Oh, yeah,
kids
they
adore
do.
That sort of self-immolation. They love it. They really do. It's not self-immolation. It's imposed immolation, I suppose.
Imposed,
but they love it. No, kids like that. When he goes into the chamber and he kills the kid. Kids love watching kids get slaughtered by heroes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or former heroes. That's what they love. That's what kids can't get enough of.
Yeah, it's not a kid.
You could blame George for all the chavs. All the chavs who were, up until Revenge of the Sith or Attack of the Clones, decent kids, and now they see their hero become just a murderous villain. Think, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point of being a good guy?
Oh.
I'm not blaming George Lucas for the Defense Society, but that's maybe
a bit
too far. But...
feet there. But yeah, no, it's certainly...
So the lies are one of the greatest of the crimes of George Lucas. Now, the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
I didn't mind the Clone Wars film for what it was. The pilot of a kids' TV series.
The film. I've seen the 2D animated series.
The 2D animated series that was released before Revenge of the Sith is amazing.
I really love that
series. It's done by Genndy Tartakovsky.
Yeah.
Who's responsible for Samurai Jack and the Powerpuff Girls. He is a very, very clever animator. I really, really like his work.
And I really like his aesthetic applied to the Star Wars universe. It's really good,
isn't it?
Clone Wars Obi-Wan is like the baddest of badasses.
Yeah. No, I think it shouldn't be considered to be necessarily canon because there are things that they do in the cartoon which a cartoon can do that a live action can't, even with special effects. Like there's one of the stories where Mace Windu takes on this, you know, 200 meter tall robot thing and he's leaping 200 meters in the air and slicing things. And it's just, it is beyond what Star Wars canon has accepted, but that doesn't alter the fact that it is badass. It's really, really cool. And in the second season, they expanded the episodes, made them longer, and they introduced some really interesting stories.
And they actually set up, there's a moment that does make it canon, or at least it could make it canon, because there's an episode of that, I think it was the final episode of the second season of that, where Mace Windu force crushes General Grievous.
And that's why he's got a cough in the films. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that's so tiny, but it's really neat. You know, it's a really neat little...
The whole second season, there are two plots going on. There's one of Anakin and Obi-Wan on a planet where Anakin sort of sees a vision of what he is to become.
Yeah.
And the other plot is Palpatine being kidnapped from Coruscant.
By
Grievous, yeah, and that is phenomenal. It's a great thing. The Jedi fights in there, you know, they're cartoons, but they're wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's a crime by George Lucas that Genndy Tartakovsky, sorry if I'm getting his name wrong, was not hired to do the Clone Wars series afterwards.
Yeah.
Now Dave Filoni, the guy that is directing the Clone Wars sort of prequel, not prequels. What's the word I'm looking for?
Series,
spin-off. He's fine. He's doing a decent enough job from what I can tell.
Yeah.
It's not, again, it doesn't stand side by side with the Star Wars saga. But as a spin-off animated series, there's a lot worse out there.
Yeah.
And I think
Did you ever see the RoboCop animated series?
Yeah, I did.
That's the lot worse that's out there.
Point proved, absolutely. So there's it's high quality for what it is. It's not, you know, side by side with the original trilogy.
Yeah.
It's not that good.
It's not episode 2.5.
No, but it is a very good spin-off. set in the Star Wars universe. And the film, again, it's a pilot to the series. It's not another Star Wars chapter, but it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Cool.
Yeah. So the crime there is basically not taking a guy, like Irvin Kershner all over again, a guy's taken your baby and made it better. And then you just get rid of him, yeah.
No, I don't like you. You're better than me.
Yeah.
I bet you that was it. I bet you get a flashback. And he went, oh, bugger, no, they're going to like you more than me again. No, get off. Get.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Because really, the Clone Wars themselves now are something of both a big plus and a big minus for me for the prequel trilogy.
Okay.
In the way that they're realised. Purely because, on a very, very simple level, when I heard them talk about the Clone Wars in Star Wars, I always thought it was the Republic against clones.
Jedi versus clones.
Yeah, Jedi versus clones.
Yeah.
You know. And of course, and there was no reason for me to think that. I mean, the line just refers to the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
That's it. But it's just, I don't know, is it implied in the way you said it? I mean, you said you felt the same. Is it maybe just automatically...
It was one of the original story concepts for The Empire Strikes Back was that Lando Calrissian was a clone from the Clone Wars, a leftover from the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
And that the clones had fought the Jedi. That was the original intention in Star Wars and according to The Empire Strikes Back, in The Empire Strikes Back. And it wasn't until Attack of the Clones that he decided, actually... The stormtroopers are clones. Yeah. And he said that, you know, Boba Fett was meant to be a clone. And that there were, in The Empire Strikes Back, there's a connection between Boba Fett and the stormtroopers because they're both from the same... No, rubbish. You're lying. You're absolutely lying there. You thought it was Lando, and then you change your mind, and now you're making it up for Attack of the Clones. Yeah. Shut up. And liar.
Do you know what really bothers me? It's quite funny, actually. We watched the original trilogy recently, obviously, in preparation for this podcast. And we noted, not for the first time, obviously, but for the most recent time, that the stormtroopers are rubbish shots.
Yes.
To a man, they can't hit anything.
Yeah.
In fact, anyone...
It wasn't sand people, only stormtroopers are this accurate. Yeah, okay.
After that shot of them completely missing 3PO and R2 going through the ground.
Yeah,
exactly. You know.
The slowest moving droid in Star Wars.
Everyone in the original trilogy who isn't Princess Leia or Boba Fett is a crap shot.
Yes.
Now...
Even Boba Fett never hits.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
He never shoots anyone.
He just aims his gun.
He misses Luke on Bespin.
I tell you, Han gets an awesome shot on Vader. It's just Vader's got bulletproof hands.
Yes, he does. Yeah, and he also gets a good shot on the stormtrooper who shoots Leia. So Han's a pretty good shot.
Yeah, Han's all right. Yeah, he's up.
Chewie's a good shot because he shoots a moving speeder bike. But everyone else, rubbish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet then we are told that the clones are all... The stormtroopers are all clones of... Jango Fett, who is essentially Boba Fett, who, as we know, is the baddest badass in all the galaxy.
Yes.
Why are they all rubbish in the original
trilogy?
Well,
maybe it's because Boba Fett can't shoot for sugar.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why, you know, because he shoots at Luke and misses.
Yeah.
And then in Return of the Jedi, he stood on the skiff, and he's shooting at Luke again, who's got his back to him.
Yeah.
And he misses four or five times before he gets hit by Han into the Sarlacc.
Yeah.
Maybe Jango is all about publicity. Maybe he calls himself the biggest, baddest guy in the galaxy. Actually, he's rubbish. The only person he actually manages to kill is that non-Jedi alien creature, you know, who, for all we know, whose hands aren't designed to hold a lightsaber.
Yeah. True.
And the woman that he hired, but she was lying on the floor at the time.
Yeah. And, it just bothers me that. I mean, and again, it can be explained in the expanded universe and so on. You know, the clones didn't work after a while and they went back to training men and so on.
Yes.
But still, I'm sorry, I can't figure out any reason why an army of Jango Fetts at your beck and call would be less effective than these rubbish shooters who walk into low doors and, you know...
And, you know, on the other hand, narratively, you can't have crack shots as the rank and file troops because your heroes would be dead in seconds.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Again, but then, he didn't need to write himself into the corner that Jango was the source of the clone troopers.
Absolutely.
The original trilogy existed first, so right to fit that.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's the trouble. On that side of things, I was kind of annoyed by the Clone Wars. That, you know, A, that they were sort of not what I expected.
Yeah.
And B, that they created this kind of problem with the Stormtroopers.
Yeah.
But that said, the problem with Stormtroopers, we've talked about. The other thing with the Clone Wars not being what I first thought, but actually being that it was the Jedi and clones against separatists. Once I got over that, they're actually kind of cool. I really like all the battle scenes on Kashyyyk in the third one, and on Geonosis in
the second one. Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
When Yoda turns up in that dropship with all the clone troopers around him, you know, it's really cool.
It is very. It's and a real punch in the air moment.
All the stuff in the Clone Wars series, again, with Obi-Wan and leading troops
and
of clones.
The other
bits
where you focus on a small squad of troopers and how they survive, and you focus on different Jedi, and you focus on different aspects and different people. It's fantastic. You look at the psychology of the clones.
Yeah.
How do they differentiate themselves? You know, there are millions and millions of clones of one man, so you're essentially the same as all of your comrades. Yeah. How do you make yourself stand out? Do you have that need to be individual or not? You know, it's really good the way they look into some of that.
Yeah, it's really well realised.
Mm.
But it's just, you know, again, it comes back to this annoying of, I want this prequel trilogy to really well realise Darth Vader, and instead it gets Darth Vader all kinds of wrong.
Yeah.
But the Stormtroopers are the best bloody thing in it! What's that about?
Absolutely. So there we have it. There we have the crimes, the misdemeanors of George Lucas surrounding his time-honoured Star Wars trilogy.
Yeah.
And I think that's, unless you've got anything you'd like to add, that's the end of our bonus podcast, part two of the Star Wars box set.
Yeah, hope you enjoyed it.
Absolutely. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back just after the new year with the continuation of season two.
Yeah.
We also have a feature presentation to come up in the next couple of months, so stay tuned. And look after yourselves and each other.